I concentrate, I can see it's blank, or I can see skeleton. Then on the next reading, I can see my head, then the rest is skeleton. So another day when I try, I can see, yeah, I can catch my After that, it goes to breathing meditation. Always when I go to breathing meditation. So in that case, should I concentrate on breathing meditation, or should I focus on body mindfulness?
I would ask you, you know, which object of meditation can you do where it nicely occupies your awareness, you stay present, you don't get lost in thoughts, and then if some peacefulness comes up, that's even better yet. So which object of meditation can you get that?
Breathing.
Then that's the one to do. Okay. All right.
Bhante, do you have any qualities of Arahant Ananda that you would like to share with us?
Arahant qualities of Ananda.
Yes, we are.
Okay, yeah, Ananda. Okay, Arahant qualities of Ananda. Well, Ananda is kind of an interesting character. So he was the Buddha's kind of right-hand man for a lot of the time in the suttas. So he was very close to the Buddha in that way. And he had excellent powers of memorizing. He recited the suttas at the first council after the Buddha died. All of them. All the early Buddhist texts, apparently, it is said. So that's amazing. It's just totally amazing memory. He was the Buddha's cousin, so they knew each other really well. And the Buddha would kind of tease him sometimes. You actually see the Buddha speaking to Ananda more informally because they have this basis, you know, being cousins. Ananda, he was very sympathetic to the nuns. He wanted to help the nuns to ordain as well when a lot of other monks might not have liked that idea. And it was a very radical idea at the time of the Buddha to have nuns at all. Apparently, the nuns in Buddhism were the very first order of nuns ever in all history that I'm aware of. If I'm not mistaken, there is no older order of nuns than the bhikkhunis. So the Buddha was kind of a, you might say, very progressive and very, like, you know, he was doing something very, you might say, risky by even doing this at all in ancient India. The women at the time had very poor, like, women's rights, very, very poor women's rights. Yeah, so Ananda kind of stuck up for those nuns, and he would talk to the nuns a little more than most monks, and that kind of got him. The Buddha would tease him about that, talking to the monks more than he should have, perhaps. Yeah, and he was kind of, he did attain to Arahantship, but slower than most of the other monks. He was kind of a slow learner. It is said that he attained Nibbana only the night before he was going to recite all the suttas at the first council. It said, you know, right as he laid down to go to sleep, he attained Nibbana that night before. So, yeah. Does that, that's everything I can remember off the top of my head.
Does he look like something?
Well, we sort of don't know what he looks like, but, you know, artists will guess. They'll guess. So Ananda was always credited with being the one. He's kind of like the leader of the scholarly monks. Okay, he's the leader of memorizing, the leader of study, and yeah. So he's more like a scholar monk. But that doesn't mean he's necessarily all that great at like critical thinking or problem solving or investigating. You know, he's not much of like a rational thinker. That is Sariputta, actually. Venerable Sariputta, he was the chief monk for like investigating the Dhamma, actually like analysis of it, you know, finding the connections and the meaning and digging into all the details and stuff. That was Sariputta. So that's interesting that those two skills are kind of separated out. Ananda is just good at memorizing, but Venerable Sariputta is good at actually investigating and knowing the meaning.
And we say that Ananda, in compared to Sariputta has the wisdom.
So yes.
Like
yeah. Like, yeah. So Venerable Sariputta, he was very strong in wisdom. Yes, and he was known for that. Yeah, he was the foremost in samadhi. That's what he was known for.
Maybe this is the question about those who to be deva, right? Yeah? So for them to go there, it has to be what they call being instructed like a monk in order to go there.
Okay, your question is, what does it take to go to the deva realm?
Yeah, then when they're at the deva realm, they can be uninstructed. Is it because they're also open to defilement?
Yes. So in Buddhism, if you want to go to heaven, what you have to perfect is sila. You have to perfect morality. You must be very good at it. Maybe not totally perfect, but darn good, like exceptionally good. And that's what gets you to heaven. Now, as to wisdom, some of the devas do have wisdom, others not so much. Okay, so their wisdom is kind of variable, how much they have. Yeah. Occasionally, there'll be a deva who actually says something really wise, and the Buddha really appreciates that wise thing, and he'll go and tell the monks, you know, this deva said this thing, and he'll even sometimes tell the monks to memorize that as a teaching. When the at least in my lineage, the Ajahn Chah lineage, every Padimokkha, every Uposatha, at the end of the Padimokkha recitation, one of the chants we do is called the verses from Tayana, mistakenly called the verses to Tayana. It's actually from Tayana, because it was Tayana who says this in one of the suttas. And then the Buddha explains it back to the monks and says, memorize that. That was well given counsel. So, yeah, the verses from Tayana are from a deva. And there's monks chanting it to this very day. Yeah, all the monks in the Ajahn Chah lineage. We chant this at the end of our Padimokkha recitation every fortnight. Yeah, so devas like Tayana can say wise things.
Let's say I'm using the four elements. So four elements. So when I go through the four elements, so the lights come up very frequently, and when the lights come up, I'll be distracted. Any tips to overcome this problem? Because the light is so frequent. Over the session, it will come, it come, it come. Because each time I go through the four elements, it will come up. So it's very distracting.
Okay, is there one element of the four which makes it come up more?
No, because I go through all four, so it will be...
Okay, well, you know what? Maybe pick them one at a time and really dwell on them. Like, try earth only for, like, half an hour. Then try air only for, like, half an hour. And then try fire only for half an hour. and then water only for half an hour, and see if any of those four makes the light come up more than the others. And if it does, then do just that one for like hours and hours.
Any tips to avoid going to the light? Because we tend to follow the light.
Okay, well, don't follow the light. You just let the light do its thing. Your job is to stay with your object of meditation. So if it's earth, you focus on earth, no matter how distracting the light gets. Okay, if it's air and the light comes up, don't focus on the light, focus on air. You see, the object of meditation has to stay your primary priority. This light is secondary. You just let it do its thing, and it might get stronger and stronger. And you might be very tempted, like, wow, something's happening now. Oh, my goodness, what is this? Am I an arahant or what? What is this? Don't do that. Whatever your object of meditation is, you especially continue with it. And let the light, maybe it'll get even brighter yet. You let it.
Okay, I have another question. I have an encounter. My left ear. Sometimes it will be like, blocking, only left ears blocking. And I had three occasions. One occasion, I can hear the chanting of the tape. They're playing at the metaphor.
Okay.
I don't know what they chant.
So you hear it in your mind, or your hearing is that good you can hear all the way over to there?
It's so, at first it was the bird.
Okay, well, maybe your mind is just like replaying it to you, because that's pretty far away from here.
Yeah. Another occasion is a chanting of a man.
Okay.
I don't know whether it's chanting or not, it sounds like chanting of a man. And the third occasion is, it sounds like chanting also, but more of a group.
Okay, well, there is a Islamic mosque over, just over there, and they might be hearing that.
This type of chanting is different.
Okay. Well, the instruction stays the same, sister. Focus on your object of meditation, despite these distractions. I know it's hard.
Even the sound, the chanting make you very happy, very peaceful.
Well, that's nice. I'm happy that you're happy, and I'm happy that it's been, you know, it seems to be helping you, so I don't object to that. But you got to keep straight here what your object of meditation is and not be distracted. And I know it's hard. It's actually one of the hardest things about meditation is, When strange things come up, strange kind of like, it's almost like side effects, like strange, lights or sounds, or there could be a whole variety of unexpected things that come up. But just trust that they will eventually pass away. They're impermanent. They will come and go. And you just stick with your object meditation. Yeah.
Sadhu.
I share also a similar experience with my sister.
Okay.
So the body scan, when I sit in this posture, it is rather challenging for me to do, because when I scan up to the leg area, it's like a maze here. So my scanning goes like that. But when I tell me to do on my bed, it's very smooth. I can do it very well. But then I hear noises. Noises like furniture moving. So, right above the room, right above our room is no room, I think.
Sister, I think that there's a real thing, not something in your mind, because I think there are monkeys around.
It is the sound of furniture moving.
Or furniture, or I thought something moving.
So I brought back my mind to body scan.
Yeah.
So this is like going backward, forward. After a while, no more sound. So this is what Ajahn is advising this sister to do. Do not get you distracted to the sound, whether it's nice sounds or somebody sleeping sound. I come back to the home. On my bed, I feel I can do much better than in sitting posture.
Okay, well, you said there was one way you did it, and it was very smooth. The scanning was smooth. Well, when you're laying on your bed, it's risky that you're going to fall asleep, though.
But that's how Ananda got enlightened.
Well, he was just laying down. Apparently, his head just touched that pillow, and then he broke through. Yeah. Okay, okay, well, if you don't fall asleep, I suppose it's okay, but most meditation teachers would not like this because they're going to be like, oh, now everybody's going to want to lay down and meditate, you know, they're going to lay down and quote-unquote meditate, right?
So, I mean, during the body scan, when I was lying down, I can feel heavy head. It's like very solid here, and as the scan goes down, I can feel the muscle like that, you know. And then when it comes to the stomach area, I can feel the wind already. So I thought maybe I was a bit hungry, but I had a drink of water to that. So the wind, and then down to the feet, because I was very cool, and I started doing that process. So it was like I was able to know all these happenings in the body, biologically speaking.
Okay, okay. Well, as long as you... now, I have to warn you about a danger here, though. There is this mistake that's pretty easy to make. And the suttas don't really talk about it, other than to say, have good energy, have good virya. But like, if we're trying to meditate and we're just getting really sleepy, you know, maybe we ate too much breakfast or something, or we didn't sleep very well last night, and we just kind of have low energy and we start to very gradually drift into sleep, okay? And we drift into sleep so gradually that we kind of don't even notice it. It kind of creeps up on us. And then we can be kind of like 70-80% asleep, but we're still technically kind of awake, you know, and the mind's in a very kind of low energy state, kind of weak, and maybe there's a little bit of even peacefulness there, but it's weak. Okay. I've heard one monk call this, he calls it a dulna. It's not a jhana. He calls it a dulna. As in, like, it's like a dull jhana.
D-U-L-L.
Yeah, D-U-L-L, like dull, like in a dull state. Yeah. So just make sure you don't get into this dullna state of, like, low energy. Even if you're slightly peaceful, that's not good. You want good energy, you know. You probably should do walking meditation in that case if you get that way. So yeah, keep an eye on your energy, and it needs to be even. It needs to be good energy, like definitely wakeful. Definitely, you know, you're in like a fully non-sleepy state. Okay, so that's the danger here, is drifting off into that dullness state. Okay. Okay, well, this is probably enough for now. If you have more questions this afternoon, you know, please ask then. Okay, so, yeah, sharing circle tomorrow, 2:30. Now, today's Friday, and tomorrow is Saturday. These are your last two full days, okay? And... it's usually, you know, like this is your deepest time into the retreat where you can hopefully get into like a groove of some kind. You want, you know, most of the deepest meditating will be happening like today and tomorrow kind of thing. And please don't be in a hurry to go back home. If you're feeling the call, you know, you're feeling the urge, please try to put it off. Now, if you really, really have to go back early, okay, well, I guess I can't stop you, but I would say, you know, you worked hard to get to this most favorable time. Okay, this is the best favorable time, is deep into the retreat. You worked hard to get just to these days, these most valuable days. So please don't run away. If you can take it, you can take it. You know, this is the best time. Okay, there's going to be people here. This is their best time, their best meditation. Okay.
Yeah, I don't like question that is called. Is there a recommended posture for sitting meditation, or is it just anything goes?
Well, the Buddha would just very briefly say, you know, sit with legs crosswise. You know, sitting cross-legged, legs crosswise, but he never really makes a big point that this is mandatory. He speaks of it in a way of like, well, this is normal, you know. He doesn't dwell on it. He doesn't get into your posture. He doesn't get into your need to do some yoga maybe or something. He doesn't dwell on this point at all. This is just another one of these strange places where, like, he says so little. It's just like, yeah, go to a tree, sit legs crosswise, bring your attention to the breath, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And like, that's all he said about the sitting. He just said that you sit crosswise, legs crosswise. So, so I'm going to say should. You should sit that way. But he never really forces it in a must sort of a way. It's not a Vinaya rule for the monks and nuns that they have to sit that way, or that it's like a confessional fence, or there's no confessional fence if you didn't do your yoga. There's no confessional fence if you can't sit full lotus. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not like enforced with Vinaya. Now, he could enforce that with Vinaya. There's so many rules for monks and nuns where, yeah, we must do a whole bunch of things. You know, we can't kill the ant. We can't, you know, there's so many rules that he did make, but this isn't one of them. Now, as to people who have knee problems, you probably should sit in a chair. Myself, I have osteoarthritis. You know, I've been to the rheumatologist. It's diagnosed. It's official. It's for life. Okay, there's no cure. Yeah, so that's why I'm sitting in a chair.
And I know you asked us to tolerate some pains and all that. How far should we tolerate? Because sometimes it gets a bit, it's really, it makes pain and all the back pain.
Well, if your joints are like screaming out in agony, yeah, don't sit with that. If it feels agonizingly painful, don't sit with that.
If you find starting, but yeah, okay, maybe 20 minutes later, can we move about?
Well, yes, yes. Yes, so like this tradition I ordained in, the Ajahn Chah lineage, so they're Thai. Most of the Thais, I don't know if you have any Thai friends, but most of them, they've just been born extremely lucky. They've got super-duper flexible joints, okay? Most of them can do the full lotus with no effort, like, they've not been to one yoga class ever. Okay, they don't even really know what yoga is. But can they do the full lotus? Yes. Okay, so to them, it's nothing. Like my first teacher, who's a Westerner, first monk teacher, he did yoga for like decades. He's one of the rare Westerners who can do the full lotus. But he did yoga for so long. Yeah, like there's this one fancy move called the locked lotus, okay? So you put your feet up, you know, kind of both feet kind of up here. Then you reach both hands behind your back, both of them, and grab your feet. Okay, you reach around and grab your foot from around back. That's the locked lotus. The locked lotus. Yeah. So so when he explained this, you know, there's a bunch of Canadians sitting in a room. This is in Canada. And we had one Thai nun, one Thai Meichi there. So this is like a 50-year-old Thai woman, Meichi. And she never heard this before, you know. And then the, you know, my teacher's like, can you do it? So she like puts her feet up there, bam, she like does it like right then, like, yeah. And she never even tried this before. She never thought to try it. Why? You know, never even cared to try. You know, yeah. And can do it like first try, bang. Yeah. And that same teacher of mine, when he was first trained in Thailand, one time he was doing it at, he was waiting to get on a bus in Thailand. And him and two other Thai monks, ethnic Thai monks, were waiting at the bus stop. So he's doing this locked lotus. And these two monks look at him like, look at this crazy white monk, you know, what's this crazy thing he's doing? And so he explained, well, this is the locked lotus. And, you know, can you do it? So they sit down and like, bang, bang, like both of them. Both of them sit down and they do it first try. Both of them. Both of them. And they were laughing at him because they thought this was like silly. Like, why would you do this, right? It looks funny, right? To their mind, it looks funny because they never do it. But, you know, they could do it is the thing, right? So, yeah, so, you know, some people are just gifted with this, okay? Some people are gifted with more flexible bodies. Now, you can increase your flexibility with yoga. And I would say, yeah, you would do well to do that. That's a very good skill. The Buddha never taught it. But I am certain it will help you with your health, okay? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, like the number of Westerners who can do the locked lotus are not very many. Usually Westerners have pretty tight joints. You know, they're... The number of Westerners, let's say in Canada or the U.S., who can all do the locked lotus, like if you brought them all into one room, there wouldn't be all that many of them, okay? I'm going to guess hundreds, perhaps low thousands. And this is, you know, hundreds of millions of people, low thousands could ever do this. So, you know, this is like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000. It's more like 1 in 10,000. Something like that. 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 can do it. It's super rare that a Westerner can do it.
Okay. The problem is slouching. So one goes to dense slouch. So after a few minutes, you know, the body tends to slouch. The need to straighten can be a bit disruptive. Is it a good idea to constantly straighten or let it slouch sometime?
Okay, so the question is about slouching. Well, if there were a gym here, I would gladly recommend any exercises which develop your back muscles. It's those back muscles which pull and make open up your chest, like actual muscles. You know, do that, eh? Like, sure, you can consciously open your chest, you know, but when you actually have back muscles there, oh yeah, then now it's way easier. Okay, so I'm going to say any exercises where you develop your back muscles and also your core muscles. So like the muscles on the sides of your torso, any kind of core muscle exercise. Like, you know, when you see bodybuilder type guys and like they got all those little like chiseled muscles kind of on the sides and stuff. Those are the core muscles. Those muscles, the job of them is to hold the torso very nice and straight. And, you know, maybe even pick up a heavy thing as well, you know. Yeah, so, you know, yoga is going to give flexibility, but there's something to be said for actual muscles too. Muscles to hold up the posture. Yeah. So I would say, like, what can you do in the future? Let's say core muscle exercise or back muscle exercise. But be careful, because sometimes if people do these back muscle exercises and they kind of aren't carefully done, you can pinch the nerves in your spine, and that's very, very bad. I know this one Buddhist guy, and he worked out a lot. He's actually pretty built, but then he somehow pinched the nerves in his spine. And now, like, he lives with this nerve pain all the time, and it's really bad. So just be careful about that. Yeah, there are careful ways of doing these exercises, and don't screw up your spine. Yeah. Lots of twisting exercises are very good for your spine. Any kind of twisting, any kind of yoga moves where you are twisting your spine, that's very good. If there was one thing I could, like, change here, like if I could get the men to do some work for me or whatever, the construction men, I would make a chin-up bar, you know, like pulling chin-ups.
Ah, there's yeah. one in the bungalow, Bante.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Just near the toilet.
Okay.
I noticed that when I first checked in the dorm, I thought, because I have this assumption that monks shouldn't be, like, doing bodybuilding.
Well, you shouldn't be doing bodybuilding to the extent that you get, like, really, like, egotistical and like, you know, start attracting the ladies, you know, when you're a monk. But I would argue you do need some core muscles just so your body does not fall apart, okay? There is such a thing as doing no exercise to the extent that your body gets into this, like, stagnant, like, almost, like, broken down state. It's, like, very, it's easily injured, you easily get sick. You know, there's kind of like this stale, kind of bottom of the barrel state. And I say monks need to stay out of that state. They need some exercise, at least a little. They have to, this is my own little way of describing it. It's like they have to get up off the bottom of the barrel. Like, don't be that guy who does zero exercise and he's on the bottom of the barrel. Yeah. Like, one has to at least lift oneself off that bottom of the barrel. But just because you do that doesn't mean you're at the top of the barrel where you're all, like, you know, totally muscly and, you know, like a bodybuilder, you know. Yeah, like even 15 minutes of exercise a day would be enough, I say. At the time of the Buddha, their lifestyle would have made them do more work every day with no effort. Like, just carrying water, that's a good exercise for, like, core strength. If you're carrying big buckets of water, like two buckets, you know, like just to hold it, you know, that's going to work out your core muscles. And or like pulling up buckets of water out of the well, you know, you got to use your kind of back muscles to kind of pull the rope. Yeah, at Wat Pananachat, the original monastery where all the Westerners ordained with Ajahn Chah, they had a well, and it was the monk's job to pull up the bucket of water. And then somebody offered to buy an electric pump to pump the water. And Ajahn Chah said, no, the monks need to do that work, actually. They need the exercise. So he resisted getting the pump. I don't know, maybe they have the pump now. I can't remember if they got a pump now, but that was part of their training, was to get that exercise.